Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our study of the Epistle of James. We've come today to chapter 4. James writes, "What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures, your desires that wage war in your members? You lust, you desire, you do not have, so you commit murder, and you are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. Then you ask, you do not receive, because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the Scripture speaks to no purpose, quote, he jealously desires the Spirit which he has made to dwell in us. But he, God, gives greater grace. Therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives peace to the humble. Submit, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, people, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God. He will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you." Years ago, a wise pastor with whom I was talking about some church matters told me that someone had told him in his youth, "All church conflicts are about power struggles." Translation, someone rightfully possesses authority that another covets, or someone has lost influence in a church to someone else and wants it back, or another person resents somebody for possessing what they have never enjoyed. Whatever the situation, upset and envious because of what they desire and can't have, or have lost and can't seem to retrieve, they in their vanity go so far as to literally raise hell itself to acquire for themselves what presently belongs to others. People sometimes wonder why it is that Christians in our churches can't get along among themselves. Well, actually, more often than not, they do, but there are always issues. This passage will explain to us why it is that we sometimes have these frictions and fissures in our churches, whether the conflict is in the home, in the neighborhood, in the workplace, or the church. It pretty much goes back to the same old things. Discord, wherever it appears, generally has the same old roots. People sometimes wonder why their prayer life is so impotent. You'll hear people say, "God never seems to answer my prayers." People wonder why they can't seem to get close to God. They wonder sometimes why the practice of their religion, and their religion, I'm talking about Christianity, their practice of their Christianity seems more of a burden than a blessing. Well, a lot of answers to those questions are right here in that passage that I just read. Let me share with you the historical context of this text before we move on. I'm citing another biblical scholar. These verses reveal an appalling state of moral depravity in these diaspora congregations. Remember, James is writing to Jewish congregations scattered throughout the Greco-Roman world. strife, self-indulgence, lust, even murder, covetousness, adultery, envy, pride, slander are rife. The conception of prayer seems to have been altogether wrong among these people, I'm still quoting, and they appear to be given over wholly to a life of pleasure. It must have been terrible for the writer to contemplate such a sink of iniquity. I think that's exaggerated, perhaps not, but in any case, the conditions, the spiritual conditions among these Jewish Christians to whom James is writing, is far, far from the Christian ideal. When we think of the Jewish congregations that James is addressing, what he says about their internal condition, it does shock us and even disorient us unless we understand the historical situation rightly. Folks, there's a lot of romanticism out there about the purity and the power of so-called New Testament churches. You're always hearing, always have, as long as I've been alive, people coming to town, holding seminars, writing books, you have it, about the power and the purity of the New Testament churches and why we have lost it. Well, actually, here's reality rather than romanticism. It was not long until the things we see today manifested themselves in the churches of that period too, and all we have to do is read the New Testament epistles with a sharp eye, and we see that. An analogy to the present helps, I think. Just as today in our local churches, you have some who are, well, let's say, more Baptist than genuine Christian, or you could put in there Presbyterian or pick any other Christian sect that you would like to. They are more their sect than Christian. They are more religious in the outward sense than devoted to Christ in an inward way. Well, so too in Jewish congregations. You had some who were still religiously speaking more Jewish than Christian, more religious in the sense of adhering to Jewish customs and traditions than adhering devotedly to Christ and honoring his teaching. So what it comes down to is that James is addressing a religious situation not so unlike what any given pastor faces when he speaks to any given evangelical, so-called Bible-believing congregation today. A lot of people out there in any given evangelical church are highly dubious as true Christians. If you've listened to my teaching over the years that we've been on radio, you've heard that theme again and again and again. If we have the naive notion that nearly everybody who walks into our churches, nearly everybody who's a member of our various churches, is a born-again Christian, we've really been seduced. We are very naive. There are probably as many make-believers in our churches as there are believers. Just as some in James' day were prouder of their Jewish heritage than being Christians, some today, they are prouder of their denominational roots, or if they're not a denomination per se, but an independent church, they're prouder of their independence than in their Christian name. And just as some today take a lot more umbrage when someone messes with their man-made customs and traditions than when someone is disloyal to Christ and transgresses the plain teachings of the Scriptures. Well, that was the mentality of some back then. The bottom line here, folks, is that James is addressing professing Jewish Christians. Some of these people were religious in a formal sense, but they led lives, in many cases, so sub-Christian that James, in this immediate context, does not bother to address them as brethren. Yet ever the pastor, James reproves them and instructs them for what they profess to be, even as he entertains serious questions that they are what they claim to be. I and other pastors do that every Sunday. Some of us may be more self-conscious of the reality than others. When people walk in my church, they walk in your church, they come in either as professing Christians or they walk in as self-acknowledged unbelievers, as a general rule. But the vast majority walk in as professing Christians, some of whom I have reason to have grave doubts about whether they really know the Lord. Nevertheless, that's not my call. That's the Lord's call. So I get up and I address them for what they profess to be, not what God knows they really are. And that's what James is doing in this passage. And what he's talking about here in chapter 4 are some professing Jewish believers who in reality give little evidence of knowing God. That things could have veered off course morally and spiritually so early on in the New Testament churches is not surprising. Robertson notes, seeing how we have indications of serious declensions, spiritual declensions, in the churches of Corinth, Galatia, and Thessalonica, we should not be surprised. He notes how the whole Gentile world of that era was given over to radical immorality of every kind, and how Judaism was deadened with religious formalism. Well, you put those two things in there, and it's not surprising that you find those things as people begin to get their spiritual feet, you still find those things afflicting the church. Also, as Robertson points out, it seems to be a distinct historical pattern for great spiritual revivals to be followed shortly thereafter by a reaction or a decline in the spiritual life of those congregations. Saw that in New England in the time of Jonathan Edwards. So this passage will help us identify the root problem behind much of the conflict and the spiritual dryness or deadness that we today see and experience in our churches, so that we can examine ourselves and our own churches, our own bodies, for any signs of the infections and deal with them if present and steer clear of it if not. Well, James opens this chapter by asking, why do churches fight and quarrel among themselves? Why do spiritual brethren who've ostensibly been born again, transformed, people who are inhabited by the very Spirit of God, why in the world would they fight and quarrel among themselves? Well, James pinpoints for us, in a general way, some of the leading spiritual disorders that precipitate such evils, then and now. Anytime, anywhere, people start biting and tearing at their brethren and getting red in the claw, a phenomenon as present in antiquity as it is contemporary, well, here, James tells us, are some of the underlying factors in the mix. One, a spirit of self-gratification rules the human heart in such cases. I quote Robertson. At bottom, Ecclesiastical strife does not differ in origin and spirit from wars between nations. Sometimes there's even more bitterness. Certainly no wars have been fiercer than so-called religious wars of history. Note that James here in chapter 4 sees an intimate connection between strife and laxity of life. Robertson made that point. We see the same relationship in the church at Corinth, where factional divisions and immorality flourished together. The Greek word used here does not necessarily refer to sensual pleasures, but rather to sweet pleasures. What do we mean by that? Like the crowning of personal ambition, the enjoyments of wealth, the satisfactions of power. Lurking in our bodily members are hostile forces, in yours and mine and everybody. They're just lying there in ambush against the desires of the spirit, and they militate against the welfare of the soul. Against these, you and I, we're not above it. We must be vigilant. It has been said that, quote, all men are naturally without self-control and are bent on gratifying those pleasures resident in the flesh. That's true. There's a close connection between lust and strife. I quote again from Robertson. The failure to find satisfaction, which means we are looking for it in the wrong places or in the wrong ways or both, the failure to find satisfaction leads to jealousy, fighting, war, and even murder. So there's our first problem when we have these frictions, factions, and fissures in our church body. What is the source of the quarrels and the conflicts among you? James says, is not the source your pleasures? pleasures, meaning not so much in this context sensual pleasures, but as I said, sweet pleasures like the crowning of personal ambition, enjoyments of wealth, and the satisfaction of power. Those are the things that are in view. Is it not those that wage war in your members? We are still in this flesh, and we've got what I always call that downward gravity. You lust and you do not have, so you commit murder. You're envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. Another source of the problem is hearts swollen with jealousy. Unfulfilled desires drive people to extremes. Frustrated jealousy foments hostilities. I've seen it, you've seen it. It's not just in church life, it's in our social life, it's in our political life, it is everywhere, but it's the same dynamics. And here somebody has what somebody else wants. Maybe have the position of power, or maybe they have a position of notoriety, who knows what. But somebody is envious, somebody is jealous. They've got this unfulfilled desire to have what the other person has, whatever it is. They covet it. And when that is not fulfilled, that jealousy foments hostilities. I remember one time, and I've had a long run here at my church, Lake Bible Church. And in that time, I've seen a lot of things, seen a lot of people, seen them come and go. I remember one time way back early on, I elevated one of our staff to an associate pastor position. Really, I made him executive pastor. We had another fellow on our staff who professed not to be interested in such things. As a matter of fact, he was very interested in such things, and he became a source of tremendous trouble. It became clear after a while that his real problem was that instead of him, I had elevated the other fellow to a position where he served as executive pastor, and he felt he was the better man. That issue aside, he worked assiduously for quite a while to try to drive a wedge between the two of us. That was devilish. What is the source of the quarrels and conflicts among you? James puts his finger right on it. It was true in that case. Is not the source your pleasures? By pleasures, here he means sweet pleasures like the crowning of personal ambition, the enjoyments of wealth, the satisfaction of power, the wage war in your members. And when those things are waging war in our members, they'll break out and soon there will be war among the members of the body. You lust and you do not have. So now he speaks of the extreme. You commit murder and you're envious and you cannot obtain. You fight and quarrel. You do not have because you don't ask. He points out another problem, dysfunctional prayer. You do not have because you're not asking. Verse 3, you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it upon your pleasures, or literally, spend it wickedly. Sometimes when things are amiss in our body life, in our church life, and in our personal lives, it can be traced back to a dysfunctional prayer life. Some don't pray at all, some don't pray regularly, and when they do pray, they don't pray rightly, James says. We ask not for the glory of God, not for the blessing of others, but when we do pray, we ask for the gratification of our own selfish pleasures, even when those things asked for are good in themselves. So says one great teacher. A.T. Robertson says, God cannot be made a private asset to further our own selfish ambitions or to serve a wicked world. We cannot co-opt God like that. No wonder God does not answer our prayers when we're in that mode. And people say sometimes, I don't know why it is, God never seems to answer my prayers. Well, right here may be the answer in some cases. The use of the name Jesus does not cause the door of grace to spring open for us unless we put ourselves under the rule of Jesus, and that includes our prayer life. Again, an insightful quote by A.T. Robertson. So here's a summary diagnosis. These symptoms that James talks about at the beginning of chapter 4, these symptoms are part of the syndrome the Bible calls worldliness. You adulteresses, James says. Do you people not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? I tell you, a lot of people don't get it. Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Let me define worldliness. Again, we're in chapter 4, verse 4. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility to God? By world is not meant appreciation of God's natural creation or the living creatures that God has placed in it, including mankind. One summer, my wife and I, for the first time in all of our years here in Oregon, I can't believe this, made it down to Crater Lake. What a majestic place. We've been to a lot of them, and this is right up there. What a majestic scene, not just Crater Lake itself, but all that surrounded it. And it just filled the heart with the praise of God to see the wonders that God has created in this world. By friendship with the world is not meant, I repeat, appreciation of God's natural creation or of these wonderful living creatures that he's placed in it, including man himself. What is meant are the values and the pursuits of fallen human beings and their fallen institutions which reflect the same corrupt values. The spirit of worldliness is such an attraction to the values, the pursuits, the esteem of this sinful world that we find ourselves driven by the desires of the world rather than the desires of Christ. We're so driven when we are possessed of the spirit of the world that our chosen ways are consistent with the habits of the world rather than the habits of Christ. And we actually work harder at pleasing or appeasing the world or our peers than in pleasing the Lord Jesus Christ. The Apostle John would define the world as comprising, quote, the lust of the flesh, that is, the desire for creature comforts and stimulation, the lust of the eyes, the desire to obtain and possess the beautiful things that appear to the eyes, and the pride of life, a craving for worldly glory, honor, and esteem. To be worldly, then, is to let these desires, resident in us all, drive and direct our lives and push the aspiration and the appetite for the things of God aside in their favor. Look at 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. John says in his first epistle, do not love the world, nor the things of the world. He and James are on the same page. He says, if anyone loves the world, listen to this, folks, the love of the Father is not in him. James says, you adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility to God? John says, boldly, my friends, do not love the world nor the things of the world, but if anyone loves the world, here's the reality. The love of the Father is not in him, which is to say, such a person is not even born again. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, which I earlier defined, the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, that's not from the Spirit of God. That is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lusts. Something's wrong with us if we're letting our lives be driven by those. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. Back to James chapter 4. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility to God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Hence, spiritual adultery. Well, dear friends, our time has expired. We thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We'll pick up there next time. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.